Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the National MS Society Financial Planning Conference Call. Your host for today is Alicia Barron. Ms. Barron, you may now begin.
Great. Thank you, Jenny. I appreciate it. And I appreciate everybody's patience with our technical difficulties on the WebEx. My name is Alicia Barron. I'm the Programs and Services Manager in the Houston office, and I am so pleased to have Hal Lind joining me in his office today for our financial planning teleconference. Hal has been a volunteer with ours for several years now and has done some free financial planning for people with multiple sclerosis, which has been wonderful. And they also have done extensive program work with us for our life planning expos that we've done here in the Lone Star region. So I'm just so happy to welcome him, and he's going to give everybody some great information on special needs planning tonight, and then we'll take questions at the end. Thanks so much. Go ahead, Hal.
Okay, thank you, Alicia. My name is Hal Lind. I'm a managing director here at Morgan Keegan, and we once again apologize for the delay. Planning for the personal needs and financial security of a loved one who is disabled or has special needs a lot of times really can seem overwhelming. You know, while the process may not be easy, it doesn't always have to be that difficult. So take time to understand the basics, get professional help that you need, and proceed in an organized fashion. This presentation, it's going to attempt to present the basics of special needs planning and suggest some strategies that may be appropriate for some of you. But keep in mind that this presentation is intended only as an introduction to a complex and highly specialized area, and that you'll need to consult with an experienced advisor to determine whether any of these strategies that we're going to present tonight are really right for you. Now, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, about 1 in 5 residents has some level of disability. That equates to 19% of the U.S. population. Now, these 49.7 million Americans are roughly equal to the populations of California and Florida combined. Another important finding is that this report is that 7% of boys and 4% of girls age 5 to 15 have some level of disability. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they report that a child is born with autism, for example, one now out of every 150 American births, and every 70 seconds, someone in America has developed Alzheimer's disease. Now, the unfortunate truth is that disability and special needs, this can arise out of accidents, many different illnesses, and the number of those with a disability or special needs is large, and it's still climbing. Now, what is special needs planning? Special needs planning, it's a process of providing for the personal and financial security and well-being of a loved one. Now, depending on the circumstances, planning for special needs can be done by the disabled individual alone, by the individual's loved ones, or a family can implement some other type of plan altogether. Now, we're going to talk more about the importance of who actually implements the plan a little bit later, but for now, I'm going to talk about who may be a candidate for special needs planning. Now, that individual may be your minor or adult child, could be a sibling or your spouse, a parent, a more distant relative, or a friend. Now, the goals of these special needs planning sessions are to balance your present and future needs with the present and future needs of your loved one. It's also to create and implement plans that meet your loved one's personal care needs as well as his or her financial goals and legal needs as well. Now, communicate those plans to all persons involved with the care of your loved one, and then also review the plans on occasion and revise them as circumstances change. This all provides a peace of mind to you and other family members and friends to help understand the specific steps that you may need to take to meet these goals. We're going to talk a little bit about why it's important to plan ahead. Now, if you don't plan right now, the government later on probably makes some certain decisions for you when the time comes, and those decisions and choices may be something that you would not want. For example, if a guardian or conservator is needed to attend for your loved one's personal or financial needs, you may not have planned properly. The court can actually come in and appoint somebody upon request who may not be the person who you would actually want to choose yourself. Or if you failed to provide for your loved one by executing a valid will, state law can determine how much property your loved one will get, and that may not be enough. But even worse, if you fail to plan ahead, there may not be enough money for the proper care of your loved one for the rest of his or her life. So it's really vital that you put your financial plans in place to make sure this doesn't happen to you. Now, what are some of the specific things you need to do? Let's take a look. It's step by step, and keep in mind that we're going to talk about each one of these steps separately. You need to create and implement a personal care plan for your loved one. Create a transition plan for the continued personal care of your loved one as circumstances change. Create and execute a legal plan, and create and implement a financial plan. Now, what is a personal care plan? A personal care plan involves thinking and making decisions about the kind of personal care that your loved one needs. Now, some considerations might be who will provide the care for your loved one, your loved one's needs. Perhaps you can do it alone, or perhaps you can share these duties with another family member or some friends. But if more care is needed, you probably have to consider getting professional help, like a full or part-time personal assistant, therapist, or nurse. You also need to decide where your loved one's going to live. Hopefully, he or she can live independently, but if not, your loved one might have to live with you or another family member or friend, or perhaps an assisted living arrangement might be necessary. And finally, you need to think about what kind of care is actually needed. Does your loved one simply need help with household chores or other daily tasks like buying groceries and paying bills? Or does your loved one need more help with things like, you know, getting washed and dressed and prepared and preparing meals? Perhaps meal delivery service might be helpful. Does your loved one need help getting around? Can you or another family member or friend provide a ride, or do you need to hire a driver or arrange for another mode of transportation? And what are your medical? What are your loved one's medical needs? You know, can you make sure that medications and injections are administered properly? Do you need to hire someone to do that, or do you need to provide some medical care, some other medical care altogether? And do you need special equipment like a walker, a wheelchair, training equipment, and the like? And lastly, don't forget about safety issues. Make sure you have safety features such as ramps and rails installed in the home where your loved one will live, and you might even consider an alarm service. Also, you'll want to have a plan in place like that alarm service just in case of an emergency. Now, your second step concerns the creation of a transition plan. That's for personal care of your loved one. The goal of the transition plan is to ensure the continuity of your loved one's care and supervision, but really it's an extension of the personal care plan that we just talked about. This part of the planning process deals with choosing alternate people and best services available to replace those in your original plan if they're unable or unwilling to perform them. You should try to anticipate and prepare for future life events that could affect you and your loved one. For example, if you are the primary caregiver, who would take over if you were to die unexpectedly, or if your loved one ever becomes unable to make medical or financial decisions on his or her own, or who will make those decisions in his or her behalf? So to ensure the plan is carried out, you'll want to also put some legal force behind this plan, which means executing some important legal documents. Now, these may include medical directives so that your loved one's wishes regarding important future medical decisions about his or her own care will be respected. Also, durable powers of attorney, which authorize somebody to handle your loved one's financial matters when needed. And your last will and testament, in which you can name a guardian who will continue caring for your loved one after you're gone. You can also use your will to provide financial support for your loved one's future, but be sure to coordinate these provisions with other financial plans that have been made or will be made. You'll also want to have a letter of intent instructions in which you can express specific personal wishes regarding the ongoing care of your loved one, but be aware these such letters are not legally binding, so be sure to include any legally binding wishes in your actual will. And to accomplish all of these things, you should hire an experienced estate planning or special needs planning attorney. Now, finally, the step four, this is in the process that entails creating and implementing a financial plan. This tailored to help pay for your loved one's current and future needs. Now, for most people, planning ahead financially includes normally for just retirement or saving for a child's education and providing for a spouse or children in the event of a parent's untimely death. But when you have a loved one with special needs, you also have a number of additional factors to consider. How much money is needed for the special care of your loved one? Now, while this isn't really an easy question to answer, you can begin by estimating how much it costs on a monthly basis. Then think about how much this could cost over your loved one's lifetimes. And then don't forget to just adjust for inflation. You know, once you've calculated the amount you've needed, you can address this question. How will you be able to provide enough money for your loved one while trying to fund your own and your other goals? Now, when creating and implementing a financial plan, one of your first considerations would be evaluating insurance coverage. Health, disability, long-term care insurance policies that cover your loved ones can sometimes offset many of the costs associated with care. And a life insurance policy on your own life, that can provide resources in addition to any funds that come from your estate. Now, we've already mentioned how important your last will and testament are because, you know, you can use it to name a guardian, but it's also the primary way that your assets are going to get distributed to your beneficiaries, including your special loved ones. Now, you should also consider the need to preserve the loved one's eligibility when making these distributions for any state and federal government benefits. You know why? Because in order to be eligible for some government benefits, the applicant can't exceed certain minimum income and asset levels. If your loved one has assets access to more financial resources than the government allows, then he or she won't qualify for benefits. So it's an important part of your special needs planning that should focus on, excuse me, I got choked up there. So it's a really an important part of your special needs planning to focus on legally ensuring that your loved ones are eligible to receive all available government benefits. So before we talk about how to do that, let's review some of the public benefits your loved one may be receiving or may be eligible to be receiving now or in the future. Now, where do these public benefits come from? They can come from several different sources, including national organizations, your community, your state, your federal government. You need to research all of these sources and apply for any benefits for which your loved one may be eligible. Now, to get more information, just put up the website, www.disability.gov. Now, let's talk more about some benefits that are available from the federal government. The two main federal government programs that provide benefits are Medicare, which is the federal health insurance program. This is for people 65 years of age or older, certain younger people with disabilities, and people with end-stage renal disease, and Social Security Disability Insurance, which is a program financed with Social Security taxes that are paid by workers, employers, and self-employed persons. Disability benefits are payable to disabled workers, disabled widows, and widowers or adults disabled since childhood, and also who are eligible for Social Security benefits. There are other federal benefits that are also available as well. such as assistance for special education expenses. So be sure to research all of these. The two main federal programs that provide benefits are need-based programs, are Medicaid, which is actually a joint federal and state program that helps with medical costs for some people with low incomes and limited resources. Medicaid programs, that they vary from state to state, but most health care costs are covered if you qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid. People with Medicaid may get coverage for things like nursing or home care and outpatient prescription drugs that are not covered by Medicare. The Supplemental Security Income Program, that provides monthly income to people age 65 or older who are blind or disabled and who have a limited income and financial resources. Now, someone can be eligible for the Social Security income even if he or she never contributed to Social Security themselves. So there are other need-based federal benefits such as housing assistance, but we're not going to talk about all of them here. Just know that there are more programs and you should research them all. So let's talk about some planning techniques now. Federal and state laws, they do permit certain planning techniques that maximize the use of all available financial resources, both private and governmental, to provide fully for the needs of the disabled. So for persons with limited means, government programs may constitute the primary, if not the only, source of funding for their current and future needs. However, government assistance may also be available to families who have plenty of resources to meet their loved ones' needs if they plan properly. So utilizing legal planning techniques, the disabled person is able to first tap any government benefits to which he or she is entitled, allowing families to use personal resources to provide for the non-basic needs. So in this way, the family's personal resources serves basically as a secondary source for additional support and comfort. Now let's look at those planning techniques in just a little bit more detail. One of the most important planning techniques involves the use of special needs trusts, which is sometimes called a supplemental needs trust. A special needs trust were given official legal status just by Congress back in 1993. Typically, a trust is considered an available asset whenever somebody applies for a means-tested public assistance program such as Medicaid or supplemental Social Security income. But a special needs trust, however, is an exception to this general rule. So assets in a properly drafted and administered special needs trust are not counted as available assets, and trust disbursements will not be counted as income under the rules that apply to the supplemental Social Security income and Medicaid. And now, this is what makes a special needs trust such a valuable planning tool for somebody with disabilities. Now, there are three types of special needs trusts, a self-settled or a first-party special needs trust is sometimes called a payback special needs trust. There's also a pooled special needs trust and a third-party special needs trust. And we're going to look at each type of those quickly. First, a self-settled or first-party special needs trust is a trust created for the sole benefit of a disabled person who's under the age of 65. The trust must be established by the disabled person's parent, grandparent, guardian, or by the court. But if it cannot be created by the disabled person or individual. However, the disabled person can fund the trust. Now, let me give you an example. The disabled person could fund a trust with money that has been inherited or received in a settlement of a lawsuit or even as a result of a divorce. Now, how does somebody benefit from a self-settled or a first-party special needs trust? We have already said that in order to qualify for Medicaid or supplemental Social Security income, the individual who's enrolling must have a limited amount of income and resources. Now, generally, Medicaid and supplemental Social Security income will look back 36 or even 60 months to see if assets have been transferred to somebody to someone else in order to qualify for these benefits. And if so, the person who's enrolling in is disqualified from receiving benefits for some certain amount of for some period of time. Now, but transferring your assets to a special needs trust, this, however, does not trigger these look-back provisions. Now, the other benefit, of course, is that the assets in the trust will not be countable as resources for eligibility purposes. And the one disadvantage, however, is that upon the disabled individual's death, any money or assets remaining in this type of trust must be used to reimburse the government for Medicaid benefits extended to the individual during his or her lifetime. Now, a pooled special needs trust, it's a trust that's managed by a nonprofit organization. What this does is it pools your funds together for investment purposes, but in separate subaccounts, which are maintained for each disabled beneficiary. A pooled special needs trust works in the same way as a self-settled or first-party special needs trust. However, unlike the first-party special needs trust, the disabled individual using the pooled special needs trust can create an account actually for him or herself. Furthermore, the funds remaining in the account upon the individual's death, this can be used to pay back Medicaid, or the funds can actually remain in the pooled special needs trust to help others in the pool. This does vary from state to state depending on state law. Now, lastly, a third-party special needs trust. It's a trust created by a disabled person's parent or other third party, but this type of special needs trust has no payback requirement. The person establishing the trust must not have a duty to support the disabled child, so the child must be at least 21 years or older, depending on, once again, that will vary from state to state according to state law. There is no requirement here that the disabled person must be under the age of 65, but however, transfers to a third-party special needs trust may or may not trigger the Medicaid or supplemental Social Security income penalty period. Again, it just depends on state law, and I'm not qualified to answer legal questions here today. As a wrap-up, you know, take a moment to just ask yourself these questions. If you or a loved one who's disabled or has special needs, are you concerned about his or her future personal needs and financial security? Are you concerned about meeting both of your loved one's needs and actually your own? And if the answer to either one of these is yes, some strategies we talked about today hopefully will be appropriate for you. Thank you for your time and your patience this evening. I'd welcome the opportunity to answer your questions individually, and I'm going to turn this back over to the proctor for those questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key now. One moment while questions come into queue. Our first question comes from Charles. Charles, please go ahead.
Yes, I have some long-term care coverage, but I've been told that sometimes you have to spend that in a certain facility. You know, you can't pick your own. Can you tell me how I need to go about finding out if that is the case with the insurance that I'm currently paying for?
Okay, just to restate the question, with long-term care insurance, can you direct your own care, or is the care basically dictated by your policy on what kind of facility you can go into? And the answer to that is probably not going to satisfy you tonight, and that is it will vary from policy to policy. So it would take just a quick review, and it's going to be in the language of your original documents or in any supplemental information that can give us the answer to that. But that should be fairly easy to find out, and if you would like to send in an email, we can research that for you pretty quickly.
Okay, yes, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much.
I look forward to that. Thank you.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. One moment while questions come into queue. There are no further questions in queue at this time.
Actually, Jenny, I'm going to ask a question. This is Alicia again. And Hal and I have talked in the past, and in previous programs that we've done, we talked a little bit about just general financial planning and how do you go about deciding how do you invest your money. And, like, you know, for instance, say you have, you know, maybe a bonus coming in this year and you know you're going to need to do some investing. How do you go about just setting up a general financial plan? So I know you and I have talked about you kind of have a little formula that you use. Can you tell us about that?
I can tell you about that and also want to relate it also to our topic tonight. So as we spoke earlier in the presentation about, you know, a caretaker's normal needs, and those don't normally include caring for somebody with special needs. So normally when we're investing, we're talking about goals such as retirement or sending somebody to school or just general wealth building. Now we add into another financial goal, if you will, caring for a loved one or possibly even yourself. The key to all of this is the word that I threw in there, goals. The way that anybody should start off or actually not even start, but start, execute, and review should all have to do with whatever your goals are. So let me just explain what that means. If we're talking about retirement, for example, we define some sort of lifestyle expense that we can give some future value to. So that's called inflation. We talked about that earlier when planning for your special needs. Once we have those living numbers, we can look at those and calculate them backwards and decide between how much you would need to save and how much you would need to earn, how much you would have to gain on your investments to actually fund those cash flows. So it's a mathematical equation working backwards, if you will, once we come up with those goals. So in conclusion to that question, how do you go about investing? The first thing you do, it doesn't really have anything to do with investing. You need to know why you're investing. You have to have goals on what you're trying to accomplish through investing. And then hopefully you can sit down with a planner, but if you can't, please do as much research as you can. Our basic philosophy in investing is not to really take any more risk than you need. So in other words, we invest to try to make money and not lose money. Unfortunately, folks would get into situations to where they would need to liquidate a portfolio, and you know they're liquidating at 80 cents on the dollar. It's not a good place to be. It all goes back to your planning and your goals, and you know that's probably a good ending place, if you will. But once again, to sit down with an advisor or somebody that can help you define your goals, put a mathematical equation to it, that should then define where you should start as far as looking for an investment and what you need as far as planning.
Thanks, Hal. And actually, a follow-up question to that I have is, so what are some of the investment products that people can look at? Because I know, for instance, looking at my retirement plan, I can choose between bonds and stocks and maybe a mix of them. But how do I choose between them? Like, can you maybe explain what those products, different products are and what that means to my portfolio?
Absolutely. You mentioned a couple of different investments. Most 401k plans or 403b plans, if you're working for the government or nonprofit, or just perhaps your own simple plan, they generally have to offer cash investments or stock investments or bond investments. The difference between the three are great. It all has to do with risk and probable results, which would be obviously a gain or a loss. The way to look at this is if you are looking for an investment that has a 20% upside, more than likely that same investment has at least the same 20% downside. So we call that volatility. Cash with the lowest volatility, then bonds, and then stocks with the highest volatility. So those are the three primary asset classes. Obviously, the less risk you can take as far as loss, the more weight you need to put on considering the cash or the bond investments over the stock investments because they're more volatile or the other two are less volatile. Those are the kind of basics of looking at what you have as far as options and why, you know, where to start going from there. But outside of those plans, you'll find other options such as annuities. One annuity that comes to mind, they has a feature that actually if you don't qualify for carrying out all, I guess it's about 80% of your daily living needs, which include being able to get yourself dressed, cook your own transportation, so forth and so on. There's a list of about 15 things. If there's just two on the list that you can't do, they actually double your payment. So it could suffice as a replacement of not being able to qualify for long-term care. We just talked about that. So there's other products that are out there that can help serve other needs. Going back to that thing that I said earlier, goals. If your goal was to have liquidity and be able to get your money anytime that you wanted, then an annuity probably isn't the right investment. Something like a bond or cash may be the best place to be. If you have a long investment horizon where you won't have to touch your money for a long period of time, maybe an annuity makes sense. Maybe stocks make more sense at that point in time. But that's, we're talking about really a starting place for discussion. But nonetheless, if you aren't having these discussions or these types of thought processes going into investing, I think you'd be making a mistake.
Great. Thanks, Helen. Actually, I have one other question for you. I know you're looking at me funny. Say somebody is wanting to sit down with a financial professional and maybe, you know, they want to meet with somebody that's in their local area. What sort of things should they look at if they're, you know, what's important to make sure that you look for in a financial professional that would be able to help somebody?
That's probably the best question I've gotten all week. First of all, it's very important to do research on financial professionals before you commit to doing business with them. Obviously, referrals are a good way to find out, you know, who to start with. But beyond that, no matter who you're meeting with, I would suggest you taking a little bit of time to do your own research and not taking the word of anybody else, a friend or even a loved one, because nonetheless, just because they gave a referral doesn't mean that they did the research. So here's where you go. It's almost a one-shop stop, but I don't want you to stop here if you have other means for research. But if you have access to the Internet, we have a governing body that you have to be a member of if you are a financial advisor or you sell mutual funds or you have anything to do with financial planning. It's called FINRA, F-I-N-R-A. That's our governing body that takes care of our licensing and make sure that we're being as honest to the public as we possibly can be. And what where you'll go is a website called, that's www.finra.org. And there's a space on the upper right-hand side of that website that says broker check. Now, I told you that as a financial advisor, you have to be registered with FINRA. They will, in this website, open up all of the records of that financial advisor's career and the history going all the way back to when they got their original license. So you can see things, if there are any, such as a complaint. You can see the number of places that they worked. And other things that may give you a clue to if this is somebody that you want to work with or not. But most importantly, the organization FINRA will give you a little heads up there if there are any types of things that are against somebody's license, and it will go into some specific detail. So as a starting point and something that I feel is a very good source of information, if you're going to work with an advisor, Once you meet with or before you meet with them, I would actually see if this is somebody that has had any complaints, how long they've been in the business, and so forth and so on. There's just a whole lot of information on that page. That's what I would do. And obviously the referrals are a good thing. You can call into the MS Society. They will help you with a referral. Friends are usually the best place to start, I think.
Great, thank you. Do we have any questions?
We do have one question in queue. Our next question comes from Paula. Paula, please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi. Good evening, everyone. My question was pertaining to retirement, and I wanted to get the latest information, if you could please, on the Roth IRA and the amount that can be contributed to that. And would you suggest that type of IRA for a person with disability, in particular a person who may be self-employed or the spouse of someone?
Okay, kind of a multifaceted question. First about contributions to a Roth IRA, and then is this a good place for a person with disabilities or somebody that is the spouse of somebody with disabilities? Did I get that correctly?
The person that has the disability is a spouse, an unemployed person or a self-employed person.
Okay. Okay, so as far as a Roth IRA, just to clarify, the government allows us outside of a company-sponsored pension plan or a retirement plan, individuals that either have one of those or don't can all contribute to an IRA. What we've known for years is a traditional IRA generally are dollars that if you've already contributed to your company plan are after-tax dollars. You now can put money into something called a Roth IRA, which if you had qualified in the past, the money goes in after taxes, so you've paid, this is after-tax income. It grows tax-free, so however it grows inside there through whatever vehicle that you've purchased, as the money's in there, you're not paying taxes, and the way that the IRS is currently set up, when you finally take the money out of a Roth, it also comes out tax-free. The problem with me answering the next part of the question as far as is the Roth the right thing for you to have or not, disabilities or not, it has a whole lot to do with your means, your ability to contribute, and what your future needs are going to look like. There's going to be an elimination period that is normally put on a Roth IRA to where if you take your money out prematurely, it's a 5-year window, then it's penalized and taxed. For a disability, there can be special circumstances. I would not like to completely outline them in this phone call. However, a quick search on the IRS.gov with a little bit of that language will take you right to the disability exceptions area of that particular penalty. And as far as somebody that's self-employed, I might want to have a conversation with your CPA, and I'm talking as you should be thinking, to have a conversation with your CPA about how much exactly does it make sense for you as an individual to put money aside tax-free, and then which is the best vehicle. So instead of going about it by looking at the vehicle, be it the Roth or not, look at what your goal is as far as how much money would be best to put away. If it's higher than these Roth contribution limits, there's other types of SEPs, they're your self-employed pension plan, or other some other type of simple plan that may allow you to put much more money into a savings plan or a retirement plan. So not an exact answer, but I think the place to go there is to your CPA and talk about what your goals are as far as setting money aside. And then once you have those numbers, and especially if they exceed $5,000 or $5,500 a year, we're going to want to look at a different vehicle other than a Roth.
All right, thank you. I think that was my question in entirety. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, again at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone now. One moment while questions come into queue. We have no further questions in queue at this time.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much, Hal. This was really informative and great information. If anybody has any follow-up questions, you're welcome to email me, and also I will be able to email you the PowerPoints and some additional documents that Hal's prepared to follow up after the call. But please just feel free to email me, and I will get them to you. And please remember that we have this teleconference series on the second Wednesday of every month at 7 o'clock Central Time. Next month, we will be talking about working and keeping benefits. So please join us for that call as well. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great night.